morning, and welcome to the WINY Talk Show. It's time for you to be heard. The talk show welcomes everyone's calls once per hour. Dial 928-1350 and tell Northeastern Connecticut your story.
Good morning. Welcome to another edition of the WINY Talk Show. I'm Paul Kutu. It is Friday, the 5th of July, and we have with us on the call line Senator Richard Blumenthal. Senator Blumenthal, welcome aboard. Senator, are you there? Hello? Something's going on. I can't seem to get through here. Hello?
Hello.
Senator Blumenthal.
How are you? Great to hear you.
Nice. Thank you for calling in. We are very anxious to establish relationships with both of our senators. We were privileged to have your Senate colleague, Christopher Murphy, on a week ago, and now we're hearing from you, and that's really good. The people around here are very anxious to know positions. So, if we get about a half an hour, we're going to strictly do policy questions and things to do with what's going on in the world. And if you don't mind, we can just get started.
That sounds great.
Okay.
That sounds great.
Go ahead.
I'm on my cell phone.
Uh-huh.
So I apologize. I think we should be okay on the reception.
Okay. Well, you're coming through okay, Senator.
Great.
Obviously, the situation that's evolved in Egypt is a very, very touchy situation for us. Democracy is one of our core values, but frankly, the Morsi Islamist government was not really part of U.S. interest. It must be a fine line to walk. What would your position be on this?
Could you repeat the question?
Well, in Egypt, obviously, we have core values for democracy, and they've just overthrown a legitimately elected president for the first time in years. And, of course,
right.
On the other side, the government that they threw out was really not in the U.S. interest. What would your position be on this? This is obviously a delicate situation.
Well, I visited Egypt twice, and I actually met with President Morsi on a number of occasions, both before and after the election. And when we were there, and I visited him as part of a bipartisan official trip with Senator McCain, John McCain of Arizona, and Senator Lindsey Graham of South Carolina, we actually warned him that his economy was cascading into chaos. He was failing to respect the rights of minorities and women. He was failed to be inclusive. He actually was, in effect, excluding many of the other parties, and he had won the election by only a small majority. And so we said to him that he was really probably going to encounter the kind of opposition that was increasing more and more, and we also urged that he use American aid to promote his economy's growth and more employment, because the unemployment rate is so high, and said that United States aid consisted primarily of military assistance, but he should be seeking more economic assistance. And he sort of disregarded or rejected our advice, and I feel that his overthrow now, in effect, recognizes a governance failure. It really was a failure to effectively provide for his people, both economically and politically, that is, in the sense of providing the kind of freedom and fulfillment that the Spring Awakening seemed to portend or promise. And so my position is that this overthrow may be a good thing for the United States. We want a stable and effective regime there that can be a partner of ours in trying to seek peace in the Middle East. And it may well be a promising development, but we need to see what follows. In other words, who will follow Morsi? Will it be the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, or is he a caretaker? Will he be a real leader, or is he just a figurehead? And there are a lot of questions still to be answered about what will follow Morsi. But in terms of the possibility of a more effective and democratic government, that's to be welcomed.
Thank you, Senator. I'm going to change gears quickly. I'm asking you, except for the Egypt question, I'm asking you essentially the same questions that I asked Senator Murphy, because this is a time for the people in northeastern Connecticut to get to know both of you, and these are mostly policy questions that are outstanding right now. We're going to shift over to the immigration bill that's passed by the Senate by a 68-32 vote. What is your position, first of all, on that?
You need to repeat.
All right. The terms of the immigration bill that was just passed in the Senate was 68-32. You know, what is your position on the immigration bill? And part B of that, does it have any chance in the House of Representatives, in your opinion?
Very good question. You know, I was a strong supporter and helped lead the effort on immigration reform. And I did so because I believe that the interests of our nation are well served by enabling those 11 million people now in the shadows to, in effect, have a path to earned citizenship. It's not just plain citizenship, it's earned citizenship. They have to go through a criminal background check, and they are deported if they have criminal backgrounds. They have to learn English, pay back taxes, pay a penalty. And there has to be a crackdown on illegal hiring, but also stronger border security. And this measure also contains some amendments that I offered in the Judiciary Committee, where we actually rewrote key parts of the bill. I am a member of the Judiciary Committee, and so I worked with various of the leaders in the Group of Eight in revising the bill, and it made it stronger, made it more bipartisan, and of course it passed overwhelmingly. So I'm proud that I was able to play a key role, but equally important that Connecticut really played a key role, because our immigration advocates from eastern Connecticut, northeastern Connecticut, I saw many of them yesterday at the parade in Windham, Willimantic, a wonderful outpouring. They really played a critical part in advising me and in working with other immigration advocates. And so we were able to fashion a bill that I think will pass the House of Representatives.
You think it will?
And the reason I say it is that they may not know it now. They may not favor the bill right now, but I think history is on our side, and the political dynamic is on our side as well.
Very good. Senator, the Supreme Court just threw out the 1965 Voting Rights Act, saying it's basically old news and they need a new standard. They threw it back to the Congress to come up with a new standard. But will you be able to get anything from the South and get any kind of a compromise there so new standards can be set for a Voting Rights Act, or does that pretty well kill it?
I am not tremendously optimistic, but I am hopeful that we can refashion the formula that is at the heart of the Voting Rights Act. And I regret very much that the Supreme Court took this step. I think it's a step backward in terms of improving our democracy and making sure that freedom is shared by everyone and the freedom to vote is effectively implemented. And so my hope is that we can go to work on it when we come back this summer and maybe into the fall and try to work for a bipartisan compromise.
That's going to be a tough one, Senator. Is your position? Now, aside from Egypt, Senator, what is your position on U.S. involvement in the Middle East with a special emphasis on both Syria and Afghanistan?
Well, I'm wary of Syria because we should learn from Afghanistan. And I'm skeptical about United States involvement there. Number one, I oppose any military intervention with troops and believe that our involvement ought to be limited to diplomatic or political means except for humanitarian aid, perhaps certain kinds of military, very limited aid, such as we've been providing, but mainly focusing on humanitarian aid to the refugees. I visited the refugee camp in Al-Sitari in Jordan. The refugees are living under very, very difficult conditions, and there are literally thousands of children without education, adequate sanitary facilities, food, water. We need to come to the aid of Jordan and Turkey, which are providing assistance to the refugees. So I would focus on humanitarian aid in Syria, but absolutely no troops, no boots on the ground. And so far as Afghanistan is concerned, I visited Afghanistan 3 times. The quicker we can withdraw our troops, the better our nation will be. We have to do nation building at home rather than in Iraq and Afghanistan. And I'll tell you, we also need to keep faith with our veterans who are going to be coming back from Afghanistan and separating from the military. We'll be downsizing the military with a more agile and even stronger, smaller force. But that means that we need to keep faith with veterans who will be leaving the military, providing them with a kind of counseling, jobs, education, and health care that they will need. Many of them suffer from invisible wounds like post-traumatic stress. They're going to need assistance in that way. And so far as Afghanistan is concerned, the government there has been riddled with corruption. On each of the occasions that I visited, I urged local officials, as well as the president, President Karzai, to do more about corruption in the government in Afghanistan. But it has persisted, and so I think that's a major obstacle, plus the drug trade there. We have done our share of fighting, and we are turning over the fighting role to the Afghans themselves, and it's going to be up to them to maintain the government, keep the peace, and defend their freedoms. We should withdraw as quickly as possible, and certainly no later than the president's deadline, which is the end of 2014.
Thank you, Senator. Excellent. Are you comfortable, Senator, with the National Security Agency's explanation with regard to domestic surveillance? You know, but being especially a jurist yourself, this is a tough call.
I am not completely comfortable with the explanation we've received so far on the NSA and the surveillance that it's conducted. There are really two major areas: the metadata collection, the scooping up or vacuuming of telephone records, and second, the PRISM program, which is the surveillance of internet communications, which, again, is troubling to me, even with the supposed warrants that have been received from the special court, the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act court. Now, one of the reasons I'm uncomfortable is that this court operates completely in secrecy. None of its rulings or opinions have been made public. And one of the bills that I introduced, even before the latest revelations, in fact, last December, I supported it as an amendment to the FISA Act, the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, renewal would open the opinions and rulings of the court to the public. Why not disclose them? Why have a secret court? I'm going to be proposing a major overhaul of that court when we come back this coming week. And based on my experience in the judicial system, you know, I was Attorney General for 20 years, and before that a federal prosecutor for 4.5. I know something about the way a court should operate. This court operates in complete secrecy. Its members are appointed by the Chief Justice from the existing judiciary. Nobody knows who is on the court. It is public, but the public has no role, nor does the Congress, in choosing its members. And so I think there is a role for greater accountability and transparency in the operation of the court that is supposed to supervise and be the watchdog. The question is, who's watching the watchdog? Right now, no one. And that's why this massive surveillance, I think, has to be brought under the rule of law. And, you know, I might just add about Afghanistan, we need to target areas of the world where terrorists are. And I know from many, many Connecticut men and women who served in Afghanistan and Iraq how valiantly and courageously they served. My son was there in the Marine Corps Reserve, 125 Charlie Company, for a tour, for a deployment. And talking to him and members of his unit, anything critical we say about the policy in Afghanistan or Iraq certainly should recognize the courage and strength of our men and women serving in uniform who have served and sacrificed in Afghanistan and Iraq and other parts of the world and done us proud.
The people of Northeastern Connecticut would strongly agree with you, Senator. There's an issue out right now that is troubling many, many parents. There is a division in the Senate, even among the Democrats, regarding the doubling of student loan rates brought on by the sequestration. What's your position on this issue, and how can we solve this?
My position is that those rates should be kept at 3.4%. Now we're going to have to reset them so that they are reduced from 6.8% to 3.4%. Doubling them is unconscionable and inexcusable. In fact, those rates should be lower than 3.4%. Right now, at 3.4%, believe it or not, the government is actually profiting $51 billion every year. In other words, the government's making money from those loans at 3.4%, which I think is absolutely contrary to common sense and the moral imperative we have to provide affordable education to our students. Think of it not just as spending, think of it as an investment. These students are an investment. And so for the government to be profiting off their backs, I think, is absolutely wrong. I would lower those rates to the same level that the big banks pay when they borrow from the Federal Reserve. I've joined a bill that Elizabeth Warren of Massachusetts introduced that would set the rate at the same level, same rate, that are charged to Citibank and Bank of America when they go to our central bank, the Federal Reserve. They borrow money. You know what their rate is? 0.75%, less than 1%. Why are we charging students 3.4% and now 6.8% when the banks are only charged 0.75%? And they borrow a lot more than students do. So I think that the present system is broken, needs to be fixed. I've started a social media campaign. I'm urging students to join. Don't Double My Rates is the name of the campaign. #, don't double my rates. Send Congress a message. I want to hear an outcry, an outrage from all the students of Eastern Connecticut and all over Connecticut, all over the country, that this doubling of rates is outrageous. And by the way, while we're at it, let me just comment, you know, the total amount of student debt, student loan debt, is now in excess of $1 trillion, $1.2 trillion, I think is the latest number. That's the highest amount of consumer debt in the country, bigger than credit card debt. It is the second highest form of all debt. Only mortgages are higher. And by the way, mortgages are backed by the collateral of people's homes. Student debt is the largest consumer debt in the country right now. And we need to provide a way for these young people to get out from under this crushing burden. They are the ones that will fuel economic growth by buying homes and starting businesses and building families, and they're the consumers whose input and contributions to our economy are the lifeblood of economic recovery and job creation. And so I think it's critical that we face our obligation here. Sorry to give such a long-winded answer, but I feel very passionately.
Actually, we are all very passionate about this. My son is 26 years old. Many of his friends are facing not being able to buy homes, not being able to have a family,
right,
have to postpone it because the debt is so crushing, and they can't even get a mortgage. So it's no apology necessary, sir.
Absolutely right. You know, my four children, fortunately, right now, two are out of college. They're in the military, one in the Navy, another. My oldest son's still in the Marine Corps Reserve, and I have two other children now in college, so I see it through their eyes, and you're absolutely right, it is crushing.
Senator, moving along, do you favor tax reform, closing of many of the loopholes in federal tax code, especially with emphasis on corporate tax? But, you know, everybody talks about all the loopholes. What's the solution to this?
The solution is to close the loopholes and end the tax breaks and subsidies for these special interests. Let me give you a couple of examples. Right now, businesses that build plants abroad and they send jobs abroad get a deduction for the expenses. In other words, they can deduct the cost of building that plant abroad and, in effect, reduce their taxes by sending jobs abroad. And then when they make profits, they can defer the profits without paying tax in the year they make those profits until a later year, and sometimes never pay taxes because they keep those profits abroad. And now, by the way, they're seeking to repatriate them, as they call it, bring them back without paying any taxes. So something's wrong with this picture where a company sends jobs abroad, exploits a tax loophole, reduces its taxes, is in effect rewarded for building that plant abroad and sending the jobs over there. That's the kind of loophole that we need to close. You know, we just reduced, in some measure, the amount of subsidies going to the big agribusinesses. They aren't in Connecticut, by the way. They're out in the Midwest, that are paid not to produce crops. Well, there's another kind of loophole that needs to be closed. There are a great many people who, in effect, or corporations that pay no taxes at all because they keep intellectual property in separate corporate structures abroad. Intellectual property being, you know, the patents and inventions and licensing agreements. They're able to avoid taxes, and in fact, some pay no taxes at all by putting that intellectual property in a shell corporation overseas in Ireland or a country abroad. That's another example. You know, I could go on, but the point is our tax code is riddled with those kind of special breaks. That's what we need to end. And if we do it, we can lower taxes for everyone.
Will the special interest money that influences election be a roadblock to this? Will it roadblock the whole movement?
Special interest contributions to campaigns are a huge roadblock, and I see it literally every day. And when I see every day, I really mean every day. The corporate interests have such sway because of their ability to contribute to campaigns. It is astonishing and appalling, and we need to change that system. And unfortunately, the Supreme Court decision in Citizen United says that corporations are people for purposes of the First Amendment, and so they have these rights to make virtually unlimited contributions through the special vehicles or PACs, political action committees that they can establish, and other organizations under 501, the tax code that provides for these special organizations. And so that kind of abuse also needs to be closed.
Senator, what are the challenges as you see them in putting the Affordable Health Care Bill into final implementation? Obviously, this is very controversial, but in order to fully put it into place, you know, what are we looking at?
You know, I want to take a longer-term view here, if I may.
Sure.
What I see is a challenge in reducing health care costs. That, I think, is the central challenge to our health care system right now. We pay more in the United States for health care that produces the same or lesser results as other countries. There was an article in the New York Times earlier this week about how we pay more for the average delivery, the maternity care that's provided to women, than other countries without measurably different results. Why does that happen? Well, I think our focus needs to be on reducing health care costs without reducing quality, in fact, increasing quality. A couple of very specific examples. Hospital-acquired infections are a major cause of health care costs. That is, people going into hospitals They go in for a procedure of one kind or another, and while they're there, they get sick from something else. All of us have known people who have had infections or other kinds of illnesses that they acquired in hospital. And so that's a kind of problem that can be readily addressed, and in fact, our hospitals in Connecticut are at the forefront of addressing. I'm going to be visiting Day Kimball later today to see their new emergency room. They are making efforts to reduce hospital-acquired infection. Premature discharges from hospitals without proper rehab is another area. People have to be readmitted. That's very costly. Other kinds of medical mistakes, operating on the wrong side of the body. You would think, how can that happen? Well, a checklist can easily help to stop those kinds of mistakes. And the medical profession is beginning to become aware and much more responsible. And again, Connecticut doctors, Connecticut hospitals, Connecticut healthcare providers are helping to lead the way. So reducing healthcare costs for businesses as well as for patients is a major challenge. And that has to be our focus going forward. And I'm hoping that we can take better preventive measures, reducing obesity. You know, I just challenged Nickelodeon to eliminate many of its ads for fast foods and sugary snacks because kids watch those ads, and the effect, I can't blame it wholly on ads, but the effect is that obesity among children has doubled over the past few decades. Obesity has tripled for adolescents, and many of the military recruiters will tell you, as I know from serving on the Armed Services Committee, that recruits are often physically less able, less strong than they were just a few years ago, maybe a decade or so ago, because of rising rates of obesity. So this issue has ramifications. Preventive health care, keeping people in better shape, stopping them from smoking, eating right, we can reduce health care costs by making people healthier in the way they live. And I think that should be the focus of affordable health care.
Thank you, sir. What is your position on the development of an infrastructure for alternative energy sources? You know, what would be the best, investments?
One of the solutions to economic recovery is greater investment in infrastructure. Rails, roads, airports, and I want to emphasize particularly rails in my part of the state, which is southeastern Connecticut, but also, southwestern Connecticut, but also southeastern Connecticut and northeastern Connecticut. Rails can play a vital role, but also roads, bridges, and renewable energy. I've proposed an infrastructure bank that would use both private and public funds to make those kind of investments in renewables, solar, wind, and other kinds of renewables.
Thank you, sir. Last question. The filibuster rule in the Senate, what's your opinion of it as how it's used, and should it be done away with?
The filibuster rule has to be abolished. Simple solution. In fact, I voted to abolish it. One of my first votes in the Senate 2.5 years ago was to abolish the filibuster. You know how many votes there were on my side? 17. And, of course, out of 100, that's not a lot. And the reason is that senators in both parties want to protect themselves if they're ever in the minority. My colleague said to me, you know, you're going to regret that position if you're in the minority. I said, you know, the Senate needs to get things done. We had 55 senators voting in favor of common sense measures to stop gun violence, and it wasn't enough because of the 60-vote rule. Likewise, the measures to pass a budget have in the past failed for that reason. And so to get things done, to make government work, I believe that the filibuster has to be abolished. It, as a fallback, I would require anyone who wants to filibuster has to come to the floor and talk.
Well, I was going to say that just now. Why doesn't Senator Reid just say, go ahead and filibuster, when you fall over, we'll vote?
Well, you know, the fear is that, and I agree with you, But his fear is, I think, that we would spend a lot of time, and in his view, waste a lot of time with senators tying up the Senate as they did sometimes in the past. But I agree completely. If a senator wants to stop action, the people of the nation ought to know he's the one or she doing it. And the only way they'll know, really, is through the actual talking, taking the floor.
Senator, the whole idea that we're doing policy questions. If we can establish an ongoing relationship with you, as we're going to with Senator Murphy, the people in Northeastern Connecticut are very, very concerned, and because it's hard to be optimistic at certain times. When we get to talk to you, we get to talk to Senator Murphy and Congressman Courtney. It helps us to understand a little more, and it takes away some of the fears. We're going to always ask you policy questions as we have today. And if you could give us some regular things to talk about or to think about, we'd really appreciate it.
And, well, you know, I've come to visit, which I've tremendously valued over the years. Anytime I'm able to come visit, I love to do it. But I'd also like to be able to phone in. And what I'd like to do is establish a regular time, and we'll stick to it. Which I do with other folks around the state, and I'd love to be able to call in and share my views. I'm not guaranteeing that people will agree with them 100% of the time, but I have always been accessible as Attorney General, now as Senator. People know how to reach me, and I hope they will, and I would love to have that kind of working relationship.
If you could have your aide, give us a call here at the station. We WYNY. We are streamed worldwide. We have full communications here, and it would be a really, really a boon to the people around here to have this regular communication. I would think that would be wonderful. My last thing is there any question, Senator, that I didn't ask you today that I should have asked you that you'd like to speak to?
We are coming back this week to do the defense authorization bill, which is immensely important to Connecticut and the country. We are doing the defense budget, in effect, for the coming year. I'm going to be fighting for 2 submarines to be built every year, not only because we do it in Connecticut. You know, we build them in Electric Boat. A lot of folks depend on the subs, manufacturing and the sub-base for our employment, but also it's vital to our national security. These weapons platforms are the most resilient, stealthy, and strong. None is better in our arsenal, and we need to continue building 2 a year. We'll also continue to fight for the Joint Strike Fighter, which we build in part in Connecticut. We build the engines at Pratt & Whitney. More helicopters at Sikorsky are vital to our national security. There is a lot in this defense authorization bill that is immensely important to our national security. And as a member of the Armed Services Committee, I've led the fight for these kinds of resources. I'm in favor of smart cuts to the budget, but not sequester. Sequester is across the board, slashing cuts, which include our defense budget. We cannot go without vital weapon systems, and we have to keep faith with our veterans and our military in terms of personnel. And another problem that I'm going to be working on this coming month is sexual assault in the military. I've been one of the leaders in this effort to provide a victim's bill of rights, mandatory discharge for anybody who's convicted of sexual assault, and the problem affects 26,000 women every year in the military, 26,000 cases every year, but only 3,000 reported. So I want to establish a victims restitution or compensation system, try to encourage women to come forward so that they do not fear reprisal or retaliation. The only way to prosecute sexual assault in the military is for it to be reported, and it won't be reported if men or women fear reprisal. And I think the military is 100% behind this effort. This policy of zero tolerance requires strong action. And so this coming month, I'm going to be focusing on the defense authorization bill, making sure that we continue to be the strongest nation in the history of the world, the strongest country on the planet right now, because we are a bastion of freedom, and we know freedom is never free. as we finish this 4th of July, I'm particularly reminded of the great heroes who serve in our armed services and keeping faith with them. So that's my part of my work over the next month. I look forward to hearing from folks in Connecticut about this work, and it's very important to the nation as well as Connecticut.
Senator, you have a hard job. We appreciate you sharing your time with us, and you've been very forthcoming with your answers, and we hope to hear from you in the future, and I wish you the very best, and I hope you have a great time around here in northeastern Connecticut today.
Well, I'm going to have a great time in eastern Connecticut. I'm awarding a Purple Heart to a great hero of World War II, Frank Bennett, who served in Guadalcanal, and I'm going to have the great honor of making this medal available to him later today, the Purple Heart, and then visiting the Kotchek Company, which provides equipment to the firefighters out in the Midwest, and then, of course, the tour of Dave Kimball. So I'm really looking forward to it.
Senator, you have a great day. We'll be hoping to hear from you soon.
Talk to you soon. Thank you.
We'll be right back.